Welcome to What is Going Om for New Thought from the Edge of Om. Each week on Om Time's flagship radio show, veteran broadcaster, author, and media consultant Sandy Sedgbeer conducts thought-provoking interviews with inspirational authors, artists, musicians, scientists, speakers, and filmmakers who are working at the point where spirituality and science meet consciousness at the very edge of Om. Here is your host, Sandy Sedgbeer.
Hello. Domestic violence has increased dramatically over the past few decades, and the figures rose even more sharply during the COVID lockdown periods. But when we hear the words spousal abuse, most of us typically assume that the victim is a woman. When the fact is, about 2 in 5 of all victims of domestic violence are actually men. That's right. It isn't always women who are left battered and bruised by a violent partner. And yet the abuse of men by their female partners is rarely covered by the media or recognised as an issue in society. The abuse of anybody is just unforgivable. The abuse of women and animals is campaigned against in many societies. But the abuse of men by women happens far more frequently than we know, and yet it remains largely a dirty secret. Why is that? Lynn Renoir is a philosopher, researcher, and author of the book The Abuse of Men, an inquiry into the adult experience of heterosexual abuse, which is based on her research for her master's thesis on this topic. She joins me now to shine some much needed light on a vast social inequality that urgently needs to be acknowledged, discussed, and rectified. Lynn Renoir, welcome.
Thank you, Sandy.
Lynn, your book, The Abuse of Men, it makes for very uncomfortable reading and quite startling, in fact. Why did you choose this particular topic for your thesis?
Well, I became interested in the subject because of my work as a massage therapist. Many of my patients were men, and some of them began to tell me of the cruel way partners in their lives were treating them. So I wondered whether this subject had been researched. But when I looked at the literature, I found that most of the studies address the abuse of women by men. So I decided that my thesis would be on the abuse of men by women.
So you found that the abuse employed by the partners of men that you spoke to wasn't just psychological, it was physical and even sexual too. Can you give us some examples of the worst behaviours from your case histories?
Well, with physical abuse... One man told me that his partner burnt a hole in his arm. Then she threw a cooking pot at him that smashed him in the face. Then she grabbed a knife and threatened to gouge out his eye. Another man said that his partner would kick him in the genitals. Then she'd scratch him and bite him and then threaten to kill herself if she didn't get what she wanted. For many men, the psychological abuse was even worse than the physical. They were constantly criticized for the way they spoke, the way they looked, even the way they hung the clothes on. One man said that if he forgot to put out the rubbish, his partner wouldn't speak to him for weeks. Then, even in the sexual area, some women would use sex as a system of rewards and punishments. If the man did something that they liked, they would turn it on sexually. But if he did something that displeased them, they would just turn off sex completely.
How did this, you know, this kind of abuse from their partners affect these men?
Well, a lot of men just close down emotionally. They can't even allow themselves to feel that they need love and tenderness and they're not getting it. They can't ask for it because that would give the woman the opportunity to say no. One man said to me that he felt he was dying inside. He said, it's like a cancer that eats away at you and all you have left is a pain that never goes away. Several of the men felt suicidal. They felt there was no point in living. Their partners had destroyed any sense of self-respect that they may once have had.
What recourse do men have for support when they are being abused by a partner?
Well, they have very few options. For example, if they ring a rape crisis line, the person they speak to will automatically assume that they are in fact the rapist.
Wow. So how did you find these men when you were doing your research? Where did you go to find men who were victims of spousal abuse?
Well, I first went to the State Library of New South Wales and I found information about groups of people who are working for the reform of the law. And some of these groups are specifically designed to address the problem of men in abusive relationships. So I went to these groups and addressed them. I told them about my thesis and I invited any man in the group who had been abused to contact me, and then I would contact him and we would consult. We would conduct normally a telephone conversation, which I then recorded.
So did you find it difficult? I mean, you know, were the men eager to come forward because somebody was going to listen to them, or were they ashamed and holding back?
Well, they had a variety of responses, but when they knew that the whole thing was confidential, that I would never use their real names in the thesis, I think they felt more confident then that they could trust me with the information.
You know, it's common in abusive relationships for the abused person to feel that it is their fault. And of course, you know, most of what we know is really about women. Did these men think that it was their fault? That they were doing something wrong?
Oh, quite a lot of them did. At first, I think they realised that it was the woman's fault. But gradually, as the behaviour of the woman got worse and worse, they started to think, well, maybe I'm doing something to trigger off this abuse from her.
You also explored the social structures which enable such abuse to occur. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Oh, yes. Well, as far as the police are concerned, in cases of domestic violence, they will nearly always blame the man, even when they can see that he is the one who has sustained all the injuries. Then when it comes to the family court, it is the woman's story that is believed. In one case, the woman accused her partner of sexually interfering with their daughter. But the judge found in the end that it was the woman herself who had abused the girl. It was her attempt to try to prove that her partner was in fact the abuser.
Do you know whether in cases like this, children are, you know, put on the stand, children are asked for their side of what was going on in the family? Does that happen?
Well, young children will never be asked. Teenagers can sometimes be asked.
And what would happen in cases like this? I mean, you know, for them to stand up for their father as opposed to their mother must be really hard for them.
Oh, the children are placed in an impossible situation. Whatever they do is wrong. They're going to alienate the mother or they're going to alienate the father. So it really is a terrible situation for children.
So men who are abused are actually in a weaker position than women who are abused?
Well, because society has come to see men as the one who are the cause of all the evil in society, if they claim to have been abused by a woman, they're just not believed.
I think I remember reading one particular story of a man who was laughed at in court by the judge and the jury.
Oh, yes. Yes, the courts take a very dim view when a man claims to have been abused by a woman. They think, well, that just can't happen at all.
Well, what is the lasting damage to these men?
Oh, the effect on them is devastating. They just lose the will to live. They feel that life is just futile.
They must lose all faith in women. And in themselves.
Yes, that they certainly are very hesitant about going into other relationships with women. And some of them just begin to despise themselves. They think, if society thinks I'm a rotten person, well, maybe I am.
Do you have any knowledge of what lies behind such abusive behaviour on the part of women?
Yes, I think because women have come to see men as the oppressors in society, they feel that if they abuse a man, they're actually getting back at all men. And indeed, they're trying to right the injustice that they feel that has been done to them.
You know, are there mental health issues involved here?
You mean...
On the part of the women?
Oh, the part of the women, yes. Yes, I wasn't able to research the background of women, but usually I think you can assume that when anybody engages in abusive behaviour, that person has come from a family where abuse was quite common.
Did your research look into the class of the people involved? I mean, was it working class women who were more likely to abuse, or was it middle class?
I didn't see any difference in class as far as the women were concerned. With regard to the men, they tended to be very well educated men. They tended to be non-aggressive. They hated themselves at the thought of ever abusing a woman. So they were really a very high class of men, I found anyway.
Why do you, what do you think is the origin of this bias against men as far as society is concerned, against abused men?
Well, there's a prejudice against men that goes right through society. The media will never publish stories about men who claim to have been abused by women. The police find it very difficult to believe men. And the family court nearly always awards custody of children to the woman, even when there is strong evidence against the woman.
Well, we know that abuse of women occurs and in many, many countries, and has done since the beginning of time. We don't know much about the abuse of men, but abuse of anybody is just completely, completely untenable. Tell me about the, you wrote that even people who are sympathetic to the plight of men today find it difficult to rid themselves of the idea that men have all the power. Why is it so hard for society to accept, do you think, that men can be victims of domestic abuse too?
Well, society has come to absorb the feminist agenda that men are the perpetrators of all the evils in the world. So because of this, it's hard for people to understand that these so-called perpetrators could themselves be the victims of abuse.
At the time of your research, because I think it was, what, about 10 years ago, you notice that obviously there was a huge lack of support options for men. Do you know if that is still the case?
I think it's getting a bit better, but there's still a long way to go.
What impact did research in this subject have on your thoughts of men and women in general? Was it a surprise to you?
Oh, yes. I mean, I was devastated to think that women could behave like this. I mean, I always imagined that, you know, women are put on a pedestal. We're supposed to be the good ones in society, and men are supposed to be the bad ones. But my research showed me that it's not at all the case. And women can be bad, men can be bad. But society only looks at the bad that men do. Society does not look at the evil that women can do.
And we have no idea why that is. I mean, you've talked in your book about what you call a feminist agenda, or, you know, I mean, tell me whether you think that feminism, the whole, you know, last 50, 60 years, has skewed things in a way that really does not support men.
I think the rise of feminism was necessary because of the abuse that is done to women. But the flip side of this is that men have come to be seen as the evil ones. There are some radical feminists who even believe or even claim that men are the cause of every possible evil in society. And this creates a terribly bad impression of men, which is completely false.
So what do you think we need to be doing?
Well, I think the media needs to be more open to the stories that men are telling. I think the police need to be more willing to believe what men are saying. And as far as the family court is concerned, they need to understand how easily women can misrepresent the situation with their partners. And because of this, I think the family court needs to be more even-handed in the way that it awards the custody of children.
And in order for us to change things, the media need to be fairer in the coverage.
Yeah, they do. Yeah. Yes, the media is terribly biased. I mean, when is the last time you ever read a story about a man who was abused by a woman? I mean, it just doesn't happen.
Well, you know, we recently had the Johnny Depp case, and he was saying that his wife, Amber Heard, was very abusive to him, but she was saying exactly the same.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that more people felt sorry for him than for her.
Yes, that was interesting and a bit unusual, I would think.
Do you think it was because that he was a celebrity and, you know, a sexy one that many women had, you know, admired?
Oh, quite possibly, yeah.
You do. Yeah. We're going to go to break in a minute. Before we go, tell me about the children. Were men ever able to prove their case and get custody of their children because of the spousal abuse?
It's very, very difficult for men ever to get custody of their children, even when the court knows that the woman has been abusive, not only to the man, but sometimes to the children as well.
Yeah. Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to What Is Going On. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, and my guest today is philosopher, researcher, and author Lynn Renoir, PhD. And we're talking about her book, The Abuse of Men, which is based on her master's thesis on the adult male experience of heterosexual abuse. We'll be back with more from Lynn Renoir after the break.
Om Times TV. Imagine becoming a super influencer. Reinvent yourself invest in your brand, and then manifest your success with a robust, spheric approach. OM Times Media and Broadcasting offers a unique and multifaceted way to become the spiritual and conscious influencer you deserve to be by putting your message across our powerful platform with its proven record of integrity and excellence. Through our produced shows, OM Times offers the opportunity to become a social media TV personality, a radio show host, an OM Times Magazine columnist, and a syndicated podcaster, all in one shot. By live streaming your show on OM Times TV and broadcasting it across the extensive OM Times radio and TV networks, you become more than a host. You become an ambassador and a force for positive change. OM Times. Open yourself to the possibilities.
Hello, I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, host of OM Times' flagship radio show, What Is Going On? And as an author, editor, and 13 times book judge who's read thousands of books and interviewed hundreds of authors, I'm constantly asked what's really worth reading and what's not. So I created the No BS Spiritual Book Club to help you save time and money by picking the brains of discerning names who have walked this path before you. There's no catch, no fees, and no BS. Just an ever-growing library of 10 best spiritual book lists from some of your favourite authors and teachers, plus free book excerpts, audios and video interviews with people like Don Miguel Ruiz Jr., David G., Lee Harris, Mark Nepo and more. From well-known classics to hidden gems you've never heard of, it's the only No BS guide to the best spiritual books to enlighten your journey of self-discovery. So why not join the club? Get inspired and save money at the NoBSSpiritualBookClub.com.
There are 16 million children struggling with hunger in America. That's one in five daughters, sons, neighbors, and classmates who don't know where their next meal is coming from. Yet billions of pounds of good food go to waste every year. It's time we do something about it. Feeding America is a nationwide network of food banks that helps provide meals to millions of kids and families in need. Visit feedingamerica.org to help them feed even more. Together, we can solve hunger. Together, we're feeding America.
Welcome back. Lynn Renoir, you have your own story of abuse, which is chronicled in your memoir, Leaving Faith, Finding Meaning, A Preacher's Daughter's Search for God. As an abused daughter, how did that influence your thought processes when you were conducting your research on men who are abused by women?
Oh, it triggered off very painful memories for me. It was very difficult growing up in a family where my father, he believed he was God's representative in the family, and he believed the words of Solomon that he had to use the rod to discipline his child, and he did so frequently, even for the most trivial thing, like forgetting to say good night or losing something or even having an accident.
Did that leave you with negative feelings about men, which then you had to kind of reconsider when you heard that men get abused too?
Oh, it was a very confusing picture. I don't think I wrote off men as a whole. I tried to put my father in one particular box, and hopefully other men were not going to be in that box.
Yeah. I mean, your father was a fundamentalist evangelist, and he believed that every word in the Bible had been dictated by God. You believed that Christianity was true and that your heavenly father loved you. And yet your own father, who was, you know, putting himself forward as God's emissary on the planet, didn't demonstrate love in his behaviour. I mean, that must have been, you know, quite confusing for you.
Yes, I was torn between believing that as the head of the house or the head of the family, my father had the right to discipline me in any way he chose. But I could not understand why these punishments had to be so harsh.
How did he punish you?
Well, he started off by smashing his hands across my face if I did something wrong. Then he read in the Bible that he is supposed to use the rod to discipline his child. So one day he went out into the bush, he broke off a branch, and from that he made a cane. And he used that cane to beat me on the bottom.
Mm. You have three sisters, and yet you got beaten far more than they did. Why was that?
Well, my parents believe the Bible's view that a woman has to be quiet, gentle, and submissive. I was nothing like that. But my sisters were. They were more like my mother. She was quiet, gentle, and submissive. But because I wasn't, I copped it.
Mm. How long did the abuse go on for?
It went right throughout my teenage years, and it went into my 20s until I eventually had the courage to leave home at the age of 23. I had my last beating when I was 23.
What tipped you over the edge there? What was that, you know, that straw that broke the camel's back?
I thought, if I don't leave home, my father will think that he has the right to beat me with this rod until the day he dies. And I thought, I'm not going through my 20s, 30s and 40s being beaten with this same rod. I was just not prepared to wear that.
Well, did you not think that by leaving, you were actually rebelling against God?
Oh, that was a hard one, because there was a part of me that believed what my parents believed, that I was supposed to be gentle and quiet and submissive. But then I began to meet people who did not have any religious beliefs, and they seemed to have these qualities that I was supposed to have. So that made me wonder whether perhaps my beliefs were wrong.
Your parents were very controlling, weren't they? I mean, you wanted to be a teacher, but they wouldn't allow you to follow that path, even though you were an adult, you know, and really didn't have to follow their line anymore. How did that affect you?
Well, I mean, it made me very angry. When you say I was an adult, they made that decision for me when I was 16. I wanted to stay on at school to become a teacher, but they said, no, if you become a teacher, you will become even more what they called aggressive.
Mm. And that was a no-no.
Yeah, you were not allowed to be aggressive. Oh, it was all right to be aggressive if you were a man. I mean, my father was full of aggression. But yeah, if you were a woman, you had to be quiet and gentle and submissive, and I was not.
And did you feel that there was something spiritually wrong with you because you weren't this docile female that your father thought the Bible said you should be?
Well, for many years, I thought I was. I thought I was a failure as a believer. I thought I can't exhibit all these wonderful qualities that I'm supposed to have. So what does God think of me? It was a very difficult period. This went on for, you know, quite a few decades.
And that did that cause a lot of confusion for you?
Oh, yes. Yes, it did indeed. Mm.
Yeah. So tell us what changed things for you.
Well, what changed things for me was firstly seeing all these wonderful qualities in people who were not believers. But then as a result of my research, I came to understand that everything in the universe is one. We are all interconnected. And that oneness means that we should be able to find it easy to love each other in the way that my parents could never love me.
But let's back up a bit, because you've skipped quite a bit of your story according to your memoir. I mean, you had an experience at the age of 50 that really was a pivotal moment for you. in this journey that you're talking about. Will you tell us about that?
Oh, yes. This pivotal moment changed my whole life. On one particular day, I had two things to do. One was to clip round the edges of the lawn. The other was to clean the car. Now, I placed my car cleaning equipment and my car keys in the middle of the lawn. I finished clipping the edges. When I came back, I found that the car cleaning equipment was still there, but the keys had disappeared, and it would have been impossible for anybody to steal them. Now, when I could not find an explanation for the disappearance of those keys, I had a sort of a breakdown. For days, all I could do was to walk round and round the yard, through all the rooms of the house, and back to the yard again. I thought I was losing my mind. I thought, I've got serious problems here. I've got to find out what happened to those keys. So I did something I would never have contemplated doing before. I made an appointment to see a psychic.
What kind of psychic?
Oh, I don't know what sort of psychic he was, but he certainly got messages from people on high.
So what happened when you went to see, did he tell you where the keys were or where they'd gone?
No, he said, you will never find those keys. And that turned out to be the case. But then he said, there's a woman on the other side who wants to speak to you. Her first name is Edith. Her second name starts with either a C or a K. And I said, oh, well, that'd be Edith Cavill. And he said, yes, that's the name I'm being given. Anyway, through the psychic, Edith described a pendant that I owned. And through the psychic, she said to me, now, when you get home, I want you to hold that pendant perfectly still. Ask me a question, and the pendant will swing. If the answer is yes, it will swing horizontally, and if the answer is no, it will swing vertically. Well, I am such a skeptic of nature, I thought there is no way in the world this is going to work. But when I got home, I closed all the doors and the windows so there'd be no breeze, and I held that pendant rigid. I asked it a question, and I could not believe it when the thing actually moved. I thought, wow, something very strange is happening here.
For those who don't know, Edith Cavill was a nurse, and she treated, during the war, First World War, she treated Germans and Australians, and, you know, she didn't make any difference between anybody, you know, who was injured got treatment. And she eventually got shot, didn't she, by the Germans?
Yes, she did. Yeah.
So you, here you are communicating with Edith Cavill. What did you make of that?
Oh, I thought it was amazing. I mean, it made me question the Christian belief that the only contact we should ever have with the departed is actually with Christ. The idea that you could actually speak to a person who had died, I mean, that was just beyond the pale as far as Christianity was concerned.
So how did you reconcile that?
Well, the only thing that made me think that it was okay to speak to the departed was a story in the Bible where King Saul had contacted a witch, and she was able to make an accurate prediction about his downfall. So that made me think, well, if King Saul could do it, maybe I can too.
Did you ever ask Edith, why me?
Oh, no, I didn't actually ask her that.
I mean, what do you think the purpose was? Why was she wanting to communicate with you?
Well, I think the universe as a whole had a long purpose for me, and that was firstly to have Edith get in touch with me, then Edith referred me to other beings who had existed on this earth. And most of these other beings were philosophers. And it was the philosophers who helped me to write my thesis.
So what were you thinking about God at this point?
Oh, that's a difficult one. Because of my belief in the oneness of the whole of reality, I found it difficult to understand how there could be this high being that people call God, who is beyond everything we know and who sits in judgment on his creatures. I mean, the whole thing seemed terribly unlikely.
Did you not feel, as you're talking to these, you know, dead people, did you not feel that you were committing a sin?
No, I got past the stage of worrying about sin. I mean, sin is very much a Christian idea, sort of rebellion against God. Well, I didn't feel I'd ever rebelled against God, and so I found it hard to see myself as a sinner.
But did you tell people about it? Did you tell your husband? Did you tell your friends?
Oh, no, I told nobody. If I told people about it, they would have thought that I'd gone nuts.
So how did that, having that connection with spirit, the spirit world, how did that change your reality?
Well, it made me realise that the whole of reality is one. See, Christianity teaches that we're cut off from God because of our sin. And I realised that nothing can ever be cut off from anything else, that we're all one, we're all part of this universe of love.
So, you know, you talked about the philosophers who started communicating with you and even helping you with your thesis and telling you that you need to study philosophy. Did you just accept everything that they told you and follow their directives?
Oh, yes. Well, because of the miracle of contacting Edith in the first place, the miracle of having lost my keys, gone to see a psychic, having Edith accurately describe this pendant, having her giving messages about things, and then having her refer me to all these people. I mean, it was such an amazing, amazing lot of events.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, the first philosopher to contact you was Aristotle. Did that blow your mind?
Oh, yes, that really did blow my mind. I mean, I just couldn't understand why such an eminent Greek philosopher would be even vaguely interested in a non-entity like me. So I was so worried about this Aristotle business that I went to see another psychic. I didn't tell her anything about myself. And in the middle of the reading, she said, "I see a group of ancient Greek philosophers discussing your work." So that convinced me that I was, in fact, talking to Aristotle.
Yeah, well, you then went on to talk to Jacques Derrida and Thomas Aquinas and who else?
Oh, well, that was it. It was Aristotle. It started off with Edith. She referred me to Aristotle. Aristotle referred me to Jacques Derrida. And Derrida referred me to Thomas Aquinas. And I finished with Thomas Aquinas. I still talk to Thomas Aquinas as a matter of interest.
And you actually did get a PhD, which you didn't think that, you know, you had the qualifications to even try for, and yet do you think that they were helping you along the way? I mean, obviously they were guiding you, but what do you think they were just kind of nudging things?
Oh, that's a hard one. I mean, sometimes they definitely said, I had to get answers in a yes-no form because that was the way it was with Edith. But then sometimes before I had asked a question and before they could give me a yes-no answer, I'd get a feeling in my mind about what they were about to tell me, And quite often this feeling I had turned out to be what they in fact did tell me.
Your academic studies, obviously, you know, you had your master's degree in psychology, you then got your PhD in philosophy, and then you went on to investigate religious traditions, Gnosticism, mysticism, quantum theory, and you got a lot of insights from that. At what point was there a single point where you suddenly realised that what you'd been taught about God was wrong?
I don't think there was a sudden point. I think it was a gradual realisation that there was far more to ultimate reality than just the idea of a God who has sent his son to die for our sin. I mean, that is a very narrow form of reality. I believe today that there are Christians who do have a connection to whatever ultimate reality may be, and their lives are transformed because they have that connection. But for me, I could never be connected through the Christian message. It never just sat right with me. And then when I developed the view that Christianity was just one way of looking at the whole reality, and there are a whole lot of other ways of looking at reality, well, then I worked out, well, Christianity is not going to be the path for me. There's going to be some other way of looking at reality that will work for me.
And you found it through your research?
Well, I found it through all the research I did, and the most important aspect of that research was the realisation that everything is part of everything else. There's no separation between ourselves and anything.
Yeah, well, and this is what, you know, quantum physics is showing us. So do you believe that anyone can make that kind of connection that you did?
Yes, it's not easy, but I think if people accept the oneness of all reality and they're willing to open their hearts to experiencing that reality, they can then be connected to that oneness.
Do you still communicate with your guides?
Oh yes, I talk to them every day about all sorts of things.
Really? What kind of things?
Sometimes, what time should I go to bed or what time should I wake up? I mean, silly little things, but then I communicate with them about the important things of life as well, such as where my life is going, and then I ask them, will my two books be successful? And they tell me that both my books will be successful.
Did they tell you why they would be successful?
Well, they feel that I have a message that the world needs to hear.
Okay. How would you sum up that message?
Well, it's the message that the whole of the universe is love. And if we turn our back on that love, then we will suffer the consequences within ourselves. People will fight each other, there'll be wars. All sorts of things go wrong when we disconnect from that basic oneness, that basic love. And it's that love that holds the universe together.
Well, thinking about that love, how do you feel about your father?
Oh, well, my father died many years ago. It was very difficult for me to even feel sorrow when he died. It's a funny thing, that, because they say that a lot of women who've been abused, if their abuser dies, they experience some sort of regret. But I didn't have any regret when he died. I mean, I was sort of glad that he'd gone over.
But could you forgive him?
Yes. It took me many years before I could forgive him, but then I looked at the terrible family background that he had. His father used to beat him, and he thought his father was wonderful. So it was a very, very difficult upbringing that he had.
Mm. So are you still talking to the philosophers, or do you have different guides now?
Well, I have one main guide, but she is part of a group of guides who are working to help me through life. Every now and again, I will talk to Aristotle about something, and every now and again, I will talk to Thomas Aquinas about something. So apart from my dedicated group of guides, it's mainly Aristotle or Aquinas.
Hmm. Do you ask them things about what's going on in the world?
Now, that's something that they're not prepared to commit themselves on. I mean, I've asked them who's going to win the American election, and they won't tell me. They did tell me the other day that the Democrats were going to do very well, which they have done.
Wow. Mm. Yeah. So what is their purpose in your life then? If they're not going to tell you, some of these big answers to big questions, what is their purpose in your life?
It's to reassure me that I'm on the right track. Because of my background, I'm always fearful that I'm getting it wrong. And I say to them, look, am I getting it right? And I'm saying, yes, you are getting it right. Stop worrying.
So you wrote The Abuse of Men, or you did, your master's thesis about 10 or more years ago. Why have you published that as a book now? And why have you left it this long to write your memoir?
Well, as far as publishing The Abuse of Men is concerned, I felt it was time because of all the attention that has been paid to the abuse of women, particularly with the Me Too movement. As far as my memoir is concerned, I actually started the memoir many years ago, but there was something within me that would not let me rest until I had completed the story and offered it to the public.
Mm. So who is your memoir aimed at?
Well, my memoir is aimed at people who have not yet found what they are looking for in life. Now, this would include people who have tried a particular religion and found that it didn't give them the answers they were looking for. And I would like people to understand that each person's path is different, so that what will work for one person may not necessarily work for another. It becomes then a question of trying out various paths until you find something that gives your life.
So it doesn't matter how people find purpose and meaning as long as they find it. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, that's right. I mean, as I said before, some people will find it through Christianity. I mean, how that happens, I don't know. But some people definitely do. Some people will find it through Buddhism, through Islam, through Hinduism. I mean, there are just so many different paths to that ultimate reality.
Hmm. Well, I think both books are very, very interesting, and both have a very strong message. And I really do thank you for writing, especially The Abuse of Men, because this is a topic that badly needs to be discussed and brought into the open. So thank you, Lynn. It's been a pleasure to speak with you.
Thanks so much, Sam.
Lynn Renoir's book, Leaving Faith, Finding Meaning, A Preacher's Daughter's Search for God, is available in paperback and for Kindle on Amazon. And The Abuse of Men, An Inquiry into the Adult Male Experience of Heterosexual Abuse, is currently available only in digital format, but it is available for a variety of e-readers, including Kindle. That's it for this week. I'll be back at the same time next week with another edition of What is Going On?